But for the guests that are here today, what we're doing in this class is spending a few years going through the Bible. It probably will be by the time we're done. Going through the Bible, picking up all those passages that give cause for concern for skeptics, particularly on science faith issues, and trying to take what are considered to be the most problematic passages of Scripture and transforming them into some of our strongest evidences that this book, the Bible, is the error-free Word of God, not just for faith and practice, but for all disciplines, science and history included. And we've moved out of Genesis chapter 9. We're into Genesis chapter 10. I got some questions for you to get us rolling. We had fun talking about new scientific discoveries last week, so I'm going to, you know, I only got through about half of them, but you know what? I want to get back into the text. We'll get after some of those scientific discoveries at a later time. But we do have some very, very good ones. What we have in Genesis 10 is a passage that most people tend to skip, the genealogies. That's one of the things I appreciate about the moderator of our radio program, Krista Bontrager. She says, hey, the genealogies are my favorite part of the Bible. My sons kind of think she's a bit weird that the genealogies are the favorite part of the Bible. But her whole point is that the genealogies have embedded within it a lot of gospel theology, and that's really true. And this particular text is no different. But a question I've been trying to get us through for the last couple of weeks is, let's just run through this table of nations. I'm going to ask you this question. What happened to the descendants of the three sons of Noah? You know, he's got Japheth, Shem, and Ham. And they go to different places. Well, what does the text here say they go to? I mean, a lot of people read this and say, well, you know, I don't know where they really wind up. And there's been a lot of dispute and debate, for example, over Ham, particularly because it's his son that gets cursed. And people have been speculating who these Hamites are. But what's interesting is this text, Genesis 10, is most specific about the location of the Hamites and very specific about the location of the sons of Canaan. And so this is something we can identify straightforwardly from the text. But I'm going to suggest you can do the same thing with Shem to a lesser degree. The end of Genesis 10 tells you where the Shemites wind up. And probably the most difficult of all would be the sons of Japheth. But the text tells us where they go as well. And then I got some follow-up on that as to what exactly happened to the one that was cursed, the sons of Canaan. The Bible tells us exactly how that curse was fulfilled. But one question I often get in my speaking is, well, what about those of us dwelling here in North America, and America in particular? And sometimes I hear TV evangelists saying, America is never mentioned in the Bible. America has no place in prophecy in the Bible. I like to suggest that that's simply not true. It's obscure, but that's a question I kind of throwed up for you for homework last week was, go through this text and see if you can find out where the United States of America is mentioned and if there are any specific prophecies about what will happen to the people dwelling in the United States of America. Now, if you go to your concordance and look up the United States of America, you're not going to find it listed. But this table of nations is going to help you figure out who the peoples of the United States of America are. Now, this is a difficult question because as far as I can tell in my reading through the Bible, there's only two places in the entire Bible where the United States of America, the peoples of the United States of America are mentioned, just two. And it's like a single verse each. That's all you got to go by. But these are profound passages. So that's kind of where we're going to try to head for in this class this morning. And then we're going to look at the particular case of one of the descendants of Shem, namely Peleg. Kind of gives you a genealogy for Shem. And halfway through, exactly halfway through that genealogy, is this character called Peleg. And we probably won't get that far today, but that's kind of where we're going to be going. Peleg is the individual to help us get into Genesis chapter 11. and what God was doing in Genesis chapter 11, and some of the latest scientific evidences we have that help us to understand the truth that's revealed in Genesis 10:25, the world was divided in the days of Peleg. And we can now verify that division, and we can see how it supports the history of Genesis chapter 11. So that's kind of a review of where we're going to be heading in the next couple of weeks. But let me throw it back to you. Okay, we've already done this one, but just for review, what happened to the descendants of Ham? And how can we be so sure that this indeed did happen to the descendants of Ham? Okay, where did the Hamites wind up? Who are the Hamites? Some of them are the Arabic people. Yeah. It talks about, depending on the Bible, the English translation using, it's basically Egypt, which is Mitzrayim. That's still the name that Egypt takes for their airline, for example, Miser Airlines. I joked with you that that's now been called Misery Airlines, but it's based on this name, Mitzrayim. That is the ancient name for the Egyptians, and it's still the name the Egyptians today take. You've got this term called Libya in some translations, Put in other translations. It's a little bit broader than the modern nation Libya. It refers to all of North Africa. And then you have this term called Ethiopia or Kush. And, again, that's broader than just the nation of Ethiopia. It would refer to all of Central and Southern Africa. So that kind of makes it fairly clear for you. The Hamites are those that settled in Africa. But they're not all one color. You know, people say, well, God cursed Canaan by putting a dark-colored skin upon these Hamites. Well, wait a minute. Some of the descendants of Ham have white skin, others have dark skin. So it's got nothing to do with the color of your skin. And of course, when I was ministering in South Africa, a number of people that I met there said, we don't think it's dark skin, we think it's light skin. It's you white people that are cursed. So, you know, it works both ways. But I think you could just look at this little list here and say, now, wait a minute. The fact that we see variety in racial diversity amongst the descendants of Ham tells us that the curse upon Canaan had nothing to do with the color of the skin. And that will become clear as we identify who these Canaanites are. So that's easy. We got Ethiopia, Libya, Mitzrayim, Egypt. And by the way, as you go elsewhere in the Bible, you'll see the name Mitzrayim mentioned again. And it'll actually identify it as with the nation of Egypt. So couldn't be clearer. Now, it gets a little more difficult when you move into the descendants of Shem. But before we do that, what about Canaanites? And I think we covered this at least to some degree last time. But for review, who are the Canaanites and where do they dwell? They're not the descendants of Cain. They're the descendants of Canaan. But the text actually tells you who the descendants of Canaan are. Yep, verse 15 and 16, we have a list of all the sons of Canaan, and each of those sons headed up a tribe that's mentioned extensively throughout the entire Old Testament. So as you read through the Old Testament, especially as you get into Samuel and Kings and Chronicles, you'll see these names mentioned again and again. They're mentioned to a lesser degree in the Exodus, because when Moses took the Israelites out of the land of Egypt, they ran into some of these people. So, but as you move into the 19th verse, it says the borders of Canaan. It actually tells you what the borders of Canaan are. Now, for a few of us that may be geographically challenged, when it says the borders of Canaan reach from Sidon towards Gerar as far as Gaza, and then towards Sodom, Gomorrah, Admah, and Zeboim as far as Lasha. On a map, what does that mean? And by the way, I apologize. I spent about a half hour this morning going through my files trying to find all the overheads of my maps. I'll find them next week. So this is going to make the geography lesson a little more difficult. But one thing that will help you, again, you can key on words like Sidon, Gerar, Gaza. Some of them will say as far as the Great River was the territory of these Hevites and Girgashites. When it talks about the Great River, what is that river? It's the Euphrates. Okay? And one of the things that might help you as you get into Kings, it speaks about King Solomon conquering the entirety of the territory of the Canaanites, with the exception of a small piece of Sidon. Now, what is Sidon? It's Lebanon, yeah. So the Phoenicians that dwelt in Lebanon, and Solomon made a treaty with them. You know, God's intent was that they'd be destroyed. Well, they were destroyed by a later people. We'll discuss how they got destroyed. But Solomon made a treaty with them, and he conquered the rest of the territory. But what does it say of Solomon's empire? It stretched from where to where? Yeah, it went from the Great River to the Great Sea, but it actually tells you a little more than that. It went down to something called the Wadi of Egypt. Anybody familiar enough? You know, we could have a geography bee here, couldn't we? I mean, where is the Wadi of Egypt? Does anybody know what a Wadi is? Maybe I should start with that. Yeah, a wadi is a wash. It's basically a riverbed for a river that only runs a few days of the year. And we have wadi here in Southern California, right? I mean, we got lots of rivers here that run only a few days of the year, but they have a nice riverbed. Well, the Wadi of Egypt, I mean, if you look at a modern map of the nation of Israel, the Wadi of Egypt is just beyond the border that present-day Israel has with Egypt. So if you think of this Sinai Desert, if you move a few miles from Israel into the Sinai Desert, you've got the Wadi of Egypt. And it basically takes a bit of a curve. And what they've done with the modern map, they just put a straight line through it. So a piece of it touches the Wadi of Egypt, but not all of it. So it goes from the Wadi of Egypt down to the Gulf of Aqaba, which is the Red Sea, and you've got the Mediterranean on the other side. You've got the Jordan River, and then it moves on up to the territory of the Hamathites, which lived roughly in that region from southern Syria up into the River Euphrates, bordering on Iraq. And so this is where the Canaanites dwelt. And as we read through the Bible, we discovered that every one, I think there are 12 tribes here, of the sons of Canaan. Every one of them got completely wiped out. They were all exterminated. Now, who exterminated all these peoples? There are quite a number of them that were involved in the extermination of these peoples. Alexander the Great took care of the last of them. So he was kind of the last conqueror on the scene. He was the one that dealt with the Sidonites. You know, Solomon didn't deal with them, so Nebuchadnezzar tried to take care of them, didn't quite do it, and Alexander the Great was the one who finished off the very last of the Sidonians. Joshua's invasion took care of a lot of them. And, you know, what you read through Scripture is that God was pointing the Israelites towards the most evil of the Canaanites first. And they were wiped out by Joshua and his army. But those who had a lesser degree of reprobation, it took them a lot longer to take care of them. And by the way, not all the peoples dwelling in the land of Canaan were Canaanites. Who was the one exception besides the Jews? The Philistines were not Canaanites. And so in that sense, it was appropriate for David and Solomon to make a treaty with the Philistines, because they were not part of the Canaanites. Okay, another question. Why did God demand the total extermination of the Canaanites? They were wicked people. How wicked were they? Very wicked. Okay, that's great. Okay, well, let's do that. I think we've dealt with the Canaanites. They did get wiped out. God had his good reasons for wiping them out. He didn't want this kind of behavior to infect the whole human civilization. And it really explains a lot of what happens with the sons of Shem. God says, look, I'm going to put you in Egypt. In Egypt, you'll be trained for 400 years. You know, it is interesting to look at the sojourn in Egypt as a training program to equip the sons of Jacob to take care of the Canaanites. And then when came the appropriate time, the 400 years that Abraham was informed of by God, when those 400 years were fulfilled, God raised up Moses, and they went into the promised land, and they began to take care of these Canaanites. So this was all laid out ahead of time. So as we talked about the curse that comes upon Canaan, it could well be that there may have been some immediate curse that came upon Canaan. It may have been prophetic, because God already knew the state of this son of Ham and what was going to happen. But in many respects, the curse is something that was fulfilled thousands of years later. But by the time of Alexander the Great, it's all over. There are no Canaanites on the face of the earth today. Okay. Now, I mentioned that you can also nail down with a little less precision what happened to the sons of Shem. So I'm going to encourage you to go from verse 21 to verse 32, and it will tell you what happened to the sons of Shem, who they are, and where they dwelt. Again, you need to know a little bit about geography, but for those of us that are took a little bit of geography, we can kind of figure out what is this eastern hill country. I mean, most translations say, well, they settled the eastern hill country. Well, if you know your terms here, you can figure out what this eastern hill country is, or just go down the names of the sons of Shem, and you can figure out a lot. Anyone want to give it a stab? Yeah. It's the area of Iraq, and there's one name in particular in genealogy that helps us pin that down. Anybody pull up that name? You got to think back to your grade 4 geography lessons, okay? Or your when was that time when you took ancient history? Babylon, okay? Well, I don't think the word Babylon is mentioned in particular. It is when it talks about Nimrod. It's one of the cities that Nimrod and his people built. When it says the sons of Shem, do you remember enough about your elementary school history and geography to know who the Elamites are, the Asherites are, the Aramites, the Luddites, and where they dwelt? And hey, if you go down to verse 30, it says, the region where they lived stretched from Mesha towards Sephar in the eastern hill country. I think it'd be great if they had more footnotes in their Bible to tell us what is the territory of Mesha and Sephar. But the quick answer is the territory of Mesha and Sephar is a territory that was settled by the Elamites, the Asherites, the Luddites, and the Aramites. Our facts add, that's really hard to pin down. We don't have any good connections with the geography in that. Anybody care to give it a stab? Pardon me? Persia, that's appropriate. Which of these names would associate with Persia? Well, you know what? You don't have to really go back to your fourth grade geography and history. You can use this book. You can get out your little concordance and look up the term Elam. And go through the Old Testament. You'll find quite a number of references to Elam and the Elamites. In particular, you'll find that they're mentioned in Daniel and in Ezekiel. Okay, then you'll know what's going on there, and you're right on target. It's the Persians. So the Elamites were those that settled in the territory of Persia. Now, what about the rest of them? Probably the next easiest one to go after would be Asher, because that's another name you find. It's Assyria, right. You'll find texts, again, Ezekiel and Kings and Chronicles, that will tell us that Asher is the territory and the people of Assyria. So that's right there in Babylon. Babylonia, Nineveh. Asher was actually the kingdom where the capital was Nineveh. And likewise, the Aram, the Arameans, they're mentioned extensively in the Bible. Ever heard that term, the Arameans? They were a people that the Israelites had a lot of battles with over the course of many centuries. Who are these Arameans? Yeah, G- Jesus spoke the language of the Arameans. So again, who are these Arameans? Huh? The Medians, the people living in northern Mesopotamia. And again, where you pick it up in the history is when David, and particularly King David, was going up against the Canaanites. What did the Canaanites do? They realized that David was a powerful king and had never been beaten in battle. And so they went and hired the Arameans to join them in going after the Israelites. So the Arameans were not Canaanites. But the Canaanites hired them, saying, "We got problems with this King David guy. How about we give you a real big pile of money and you raise an army and you help us defeat them?" And of course that didn't work. Solomon wind up taking a good chunk of the territory of the Arameans and made them subject because of the fact they tried to help the Canaanites. But yeah, that would be between the territory of Canaan and the territory of Mesopotamia is where those people dwelt. So we're making progress here as to basically what you could say of the Shemites. They stayed put. When we get into Genesis chapter 11, we'll read about the Tower of Babel and how the nations spread. But the Shemites were the peoples who didn't spread very far. Mesopotamia is where all the peoples of the world were at the time of the Tower of Babel. And the sons of Shem populated Mesopotamia and the territories around Mesopotamia. And then the Hamites moved into Africa. Now we're left with the Japhethites. What happened to them? Japhethites. And what you get in Genesis chapter 10 is a big list of all the places where the sons of Japheth go. The problem is it's even more difficult to get out your geography and history texts and try to figure it out. And by the way, if you go to Bible commentaries, what you'll find is they kind of disagree on where these Japhethites went first. Went to Greece. It says that in the text. So, I'll give you a real easy answer to this. They went everywhere else where the Hamites and the Shemites didn't go. They began in Greece, but what does it say of the people of Greece? They were the colonizers. But that's the thing we notice about the Japhethites is that they went to Tarshish and Kittim and Rodanim and Elisha, but they were the ones that traveled. And so they were the ones that really spread out to all over Europe, Northern Asia, and eventually into North and South America, Australia. They were the ones that were always on the move. And the Greeks, I mean, they're mentioned here because that was their thing. They would set up a colony, and when that colony got well populated, they'd all get in ships and move somewhere else. And so the Greeks wound up, by the way, Italians are just Greeks that moved from Greece to Italy. So, that Roman culture was transplanted from Greece. And of course, the Greeks didn't just stay there. They went to Spain, they went to France, they went to Britain, they went to Germany. And again, we look in modern history, what did the Europeans do? Well, they just kept moving on. They were the ones always on the move, going somewhere, setting up new colonies. So that's an easy answer. The Japhethites just simply went to all the places where the Shemites didn't go and the Hamites didn't go. And actually, in this era, it's really tough because when people look at end times prophecy and say, wow, Ezekiel predicts a lot about what's going to happen and the interaction of, say, the various sons of Japheth with the sons of Shem and the sons of Ham. But I'll tell you, what makes it really tough is everybody's getting thoroughly mixed up today. There are a lot of Hamites living here in North America. There are a lot of Hamites that live in Western Europe. There are a lot of Shemites that live in Australia. I mean, people are really thoroughly mixed. Yes. Well, there's more debate amongst Bible scholars about these Asians, particularly the Southeast Asians. Some will claim that they are Hamites, but that comes from a group of scholars that would claim that the Hamites are the dark-skinned peoples. As I mentioned, there's evidence right here in the text that that doesn't follow. I mean, the Libyans and the Mitzrayims are the sons of Ham, and they have white skin, than trying to push the argument that because the people of Indonesia have a dark skin, they must be Hamites, doesn't necessarily follow. There are those who would claim, and when I was in China, they would claim they were descendants of Shem. But mainly it was for political reasons. They read the Bible and they say, well, you know, Shem's the guy on top. So we Chinese, of course, are on top. Therefore, we must be the sons of Shem. It's kind of like British Israelism. I mean, that was very popular 100 years ago in America, that Americans were Shemites or Semites. But again, that kind of doesn't follow from the fact that the text indicates that the Semites' tendency was not to move much. Now, they were forcibly moved. I mean, that's what happened to the Israelites with the Babylonian conquest. They were sent to all the nations of the world. But now God's in the process of bringing them back. So Semites typically don't move. So you're looking at people that, like India, for example, was obviously settled by a mass migration. Well, who are the mass migrators? The Japhethites. So I would probably tilt a little more to concluding that the Japhethites would make up the Chinese, the Indians, the Indonesians, etc. But not all Bible scholars would agree with that. And if I'm proven wrong, it's not going to bother me. Well, I'll tell you what scientists are trying to do now. They're trying to look at mitochondrial DNA and Y chromosome evidence to figure out where the Indians came from, where the South African blacks came from, where the Egyptians came from, where the Israelites came from, etc. That kind of analysis, however, only works if you assume, which most of these researchers do, that the migration is driven by Darwinian principles. And I would argue with the human species, non-Darwinian motivations for moving are stronger than Darwinian motivations. It's not just the lack of food or the lack of resources that causes us to move. And I think that's the big mistake behind a lot of these research papers saying the original humans came out of Africa. Well, it's true. In Africa, we've got the greatest genetic diversity, you know, amongst the blacks there. But that doesn't necessarily prove that that is the source of the human found, because it's not just Darwinian principles that would explain that genetic diversity. So we really don't know. We can't prove scientifically. Well, there's one exception to that. The one exception to that is the Jewish line. Y chromosome analysis is proving to be very effective in establishing the past history of a Jewish migration. They find Jews in Africa, they find Jews in all the nations of the world. In fact, there are those in Israel are saying, because you know, a lot of Israelis feel that it's their mandate to bring together all the Jews of the whole world. And now they're excited that they've got a genetic test to prove who a Jew is and who a Jew is not. Because as it is now, you can go to Israel and if you say you're a Jew, they let you in. But there's probably a lot of people there who really aren't Jews. Well, now they've got a genetic test. And what really might fit into Bible prophecy is that they got an even more powerful test to prove who are the sons of Aaron. You know, the Levites have less genetic diversity than the other Jews, and the sons of Aaron in particular have the least genetic diversity. So it's a way that the Jews in Israel today could reinstitute the temple sacrifice. Because what's been holding them back is they say, we don't know who the sons of Aaron are, and we don't dare set up a temple sacrifice if we don't know who the sons of Aaron are. And all you got to do is read Samuel to figure out why they're nervous about having someone engage in temple sacrifice if they're not a son of Aaron. There's a gentleman back there who got killed for touching one of the articles that only the sons of Aaron were allowed to touch. And so being aware of that, they say, we're not doing anything until we can figure out who the sons of Aaron are. Now they've got a very effective test for establishing who are the sons of Aaron. So that could pave the way, and the Bible does predict temple sacrifices will be reinstituted in this new nation, Israel. It's going to happen. So, yes. Okay, when did Noah's boys live? We covered that about 4, 5, 6 months ago, maybe Yeah, he might not have been here, but I believe that the shortening of human lifespans from more than 900 years to a maximum of about 120 is the best clue to figure out when the Noah flood took place. And I'm suggesting that the Vela supernova would have been one means by which God would have used to shorten human lifespans. Therefore, if you can date that Vela supernova, you get a date for the Genesis flood. When we get into Genesis chapter 11 and Genesis 10:25, the world was divided in the days of Peleg. That will give us a second independent means for dating the flood. The flood must occur before the spreading out of humanity to the entire surface of the earth. And so if we can figure out scientifically when that spreading of humanity took place, that will give us a second check on the date of the flood. And to give you the raw numbers, the Vela supernova eruption 20 to 30,000 years ago, the land bridges, which would have permitted human migration into all the continents of the world, were intact roughly between 10 and 15,000 years ago. And so you'd have to have the flood before that date. It's reasonably consistent. So somewhere within that ballpark of plus or minus 10,000 years, that's probably not too satisfying, but roughly that's the Genesis flood, and roughly that is in agreement with the biblical genealogies. Yes. Now, you're right. You're going to need a lot of time inserted in the genealogy from Noah down to Abraham. You also need to insert quite a bit of time between Noah and Adam. Those are the two parts of the genealogy I would argue would have the greatest incompleteness. Now, what's interesting about the Genesis 11 genealogy, we can actually prove that that genealogy is incomplete. You go to Luke chapter 3, and you'll see a gentleman's name mentioned who's not mentioned in the genealogy of Genesis 11. His name is Canaan, but it's spelled differently, C-A-I-N-A-N, or K. A-I-N-A-N, depending on your English translation. He's mentioned in Luke 3. He's not mentioned in Genesis 11. So that establishes that that genealogy is not as tight as it reads in the English translation. And hey, we got to wrap it up. I'll just say this. This is covered in our book, The Genesis Question, but we need to recognize that in the Hebrew language, there's no distinction between the words son and grandson, great-grandson, great-great-grandson, etc. Likewise, the same thing's true of the word father. No distinction between the word father and great-great-grandfather. They're one and the same. And therefore, you can read the genealogies of Genesis 5 and Genesis 11 that a particular genealogical line began when this individual was born, rather than that being the individual that gave birth to the next one. But that's explained in the book. Let's bow for prayer. Father in heaven, it's true that there's no portion of your word that's not rich in insight to help us with apologetic problems and apologetic opportunities. And Father, as people today are struggling with trying to pull together the history that we see revealed here in the Bible and demonstrate its consistency with scientific and human history. Lord, equip us to do this in a way to persuade the skeptic that we see here in the Bible indeed is your word error-free, perfect in every way. And Lord, I pray too that it would help us to build a bridge from that recognition that you have faithfully revealed yourself to the message that's in this book and the message of what you'll be doing in the future. And Lord, I thank you that you've not just seen fit to name all these different peoples and explain where they went, but you also explain what will be happening to them in the future, what has even happened in our own lifetime. And Lord, may that also give us further security in the knowledge that this is your word, that we can trust it implicitly. And Lord, may you equip us to be able to also persuade others to take this book as seriously as if we are taking it, as we need to take it. In Jesus' name, amen.